In 2003, I pitched a book about reality television to fellow journalists. My friend dismissed it as a passing fad. 2 decades later, reality TV hasn't faded. It's transformed our entire culture. What began as controversial shows like Survivor evolved into a powerful industry whose practitioners prefer the sanitized term unscripted programming. Though initially assumed to be a modern digital era creation dating back to MTV's The Real World, 1992, reality TV's roots stretch back 7 decades to post-World War II radio shows like Candid Microphone. Throughout its history, critics consistently dismissed reality programming as cruel, cheap, and ephemeral. Yet audiences remained captivated by its unique blend of authenticity within artifice. Reality TV isn't just entertainment, it's a cultural force that has influenced everything from how we present ourselves online to who occupies the White House. Reality television's first moral panic erupted in 1947 when audience participation shows began displacing scripted radio programming. These shows were economically irresistible, requiring only a host and unpaid volunteers, rather than writers, actors, and expensive sound effects. Despite being criticized as lurid and cheap, they offered authentic voices that opened a psychological window for listeners. Alan Fund revolutionized the format with Candid Microphone, later Candid Camera. After military service, where he'd secretly recorded soldiers in the gripe booth, Fund secured funding to develop his hidden microphone concept. His breakthrough came in a dentist's office when, posing as the dentist, he deliberately provoked a patient by claiming she had no wisdom teeth. This epiphany revealed his formula. Don't just observe people, deliberately disrupt their reality to capture authentic emotional reactions. The show's best sketches tested social conventions through elaborate setups, from Dorothy Collins driving into gas stations in a car without an engine to pranking Russians during the Cold War. Funt's work attracted intellectuals like sociologist David Riesman, who called him the second most ingenious sociologist in America, and inspired controversial researchers Stanley Milgram and Philip Zimbardo. Funt's genius innovation was the reveal, that cathartic moment when he'd announce, "Smile, you're on Candid Camera," and point to the hidden lens. This transformed the prank into a collaboration, providing moral relief for viewers and some dignity for subjects. A catchy theme song reinforced the message that being pranked was a compliment, not an insult. Despite his success, Funt was haunted by criticism. The New Yorker's Philip Hamburger condemned the show as sadistic, poisonous, anti-human, and sneaky. Former writer Joan Rivers accused him of tyrannical behavior. In his 1994 memoir, Funt acknowledged his flaws while defending his legacy, arguing that Candid Camera offered truthful insights into human nature that fiction never could. Though his methods were often predatory, they pushed television into new territory. A better man might never have pressed record. Chuck Barris transformed television in the 1960s and 70s with shows that tapped into America's changing social mores. After years of bouncing between jobs, from prize fight promotion to teleprompter sales, he landed at ABC monitoring Dick Clark during a payola scandal. In 1965, everything changed when he sold The Dating Game to ABC, launching Chuck Barris Productions with a $20,000 loan from his stepfather. The Dating Game brilliantly captured mid-60s sexual cognitive dissonance. The pill was legal, but women were still expected to remain virgins until marriage. The show suggested sex itself was a game women could play too, featuring attractive Angelinos flirting across a wall. Though inspired by a 1940s radio show, Barris updated it with groovy design, Herb Alpert's Spanish Flea, and increasingly suggestive questions. The show became an instant hit, moving to prime time within a year. As the budget expanded, celebrities appeared alongside civilians, and winners traveled to romantic capitals rather than just dinner in Burbank. Future stars like Farrah Fawcett, Steve Martin, and even 14-year-old Michael Jackson appeared as contestants. The Newlywed Game, launched in 1966, proved even more transgressive, designed to puncture America's most sentimental institution, heterosexual marriage. Four married couples competed by answering questions about each other, with host Bob Eubanks using the euphemism "making whoopee" for sex. The show featured regular civilians rather than beautiful Angelinos, making it a more achievable fantasy of fame. By 1976, Barris launched The Gong Show, a deliberately dopey anti-talent show. When the original host dropped out, Barris reluctantly stepped in himself, becoming the show's defining element. His nervous tics, tugging his hat over his eyes, clapping anxiously, mumbling catchphrases, became his trademark. Unlike polished hosts with Midwestern neutrality, Barris's appeal was his apparent incompetence, making him seem authentic and relatable. Around 1978, Barris's empire began to crumble, starting with the notorious Popsicle Twins act. By then, Barris was unraveling, suffering panic attacks on stage and being harassed by strangers. Most devastatingly, his daughter Della descended into drug addiction. The shows grew darker, with Dating Game winner Rodney Alcala later revealed as a serial killer, the Dating Game Killer, highlighting the dangerous carelessness behind the carefree facade. The final blow came with Three's a Crowd in 1979, essentially the Newlywed Game for cheaters, which sparked protests from women's organizations, labor unions, and secretaries' associations. By 1980, Barris Productions laid off most staff. Barris retreated to the Wyndham Hotel, where he wrote Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, claiming he'd been a CIA assassin during his Hollywood career, a story no colleagues believed. In 1973, America was gripped by two major revelations involving secret recordings: the Watergate tapes that would bring down Nixon, and a groundbreaking documentary series called An American Family. This PBS series became the year's most divisive pop culture sensation by doing something unprecedented, creating the world's first reality TV stars, the Loud family of Santa Barbara, California. Producer Craig Gilbert and filmmakers Alan and Susan Raymond spent 7 months filming the upper-middle-class Louds in their natural habitat. The resulting 12-hour series captured the disintegration of Bill and Pat Loud's 20-year marriage and showcased their openly gay son Lance, creating a national conversation about American family life. The series began when Gilbert, a documentary producer seeking to update Margaret Mead's anthropological studies, convinced Pat Loud to let him film her family. The Raymonds, a husband and wife team who had worked on documentaries about police and schools, operated the portable equipment. They initially bonded with the Louds, particularly Pat, whom Susan Raymond admired for her honesty and wit. As filming progressed, the boundaries between documentarians and subjects blurred. Pat confided in Gilbert about her marital problems, while the Raymonds became increasingly uncomfortable with their role in the family drama. When Pat asked Bill for a divorce on camera, the filmmakers felt both the power and responsibility of their presence. Lance Loud, the family's charismatic eldest son, emerged as television's first openly gay personality, though the word homosexual was never used in the series. After the premiere, the Louds faced brutal media criticism while trying to reclaim their narrative. Their fame persisted throughout the 1970s as cultural touchstones, with Lance playing CBGB with his punk band and family members appearing in various publications. Despite its cultural impact, the show quickly disappeared, with WNET destroying all outtakes and never releasing it on home media formats. The show's legacy lived primarily through satire. Norman Lear's Mary Hartman, Mary Hartman featured a housewife who breaks down on television after oversharing about her family. In 1979, Albert Brooks directed Real Life, playing a smug documentarian filming the Yeager family in Phoenix who refuses to leave when the family begs him to stop. Every decade, the Raymonds revisited the Louds. In 1983, they produced An American Family Revisited for HBO, revealing the family's contradictory feelings about the original show. In 2001, Lance asked the Raymonds to document his final days as he was dying from HIV and hepatitis C. The film captured Lance's memorial at the Chateau Marmont and showed Bill speaking warmly about his son, walking back his earlier homophobic remarks. Lance's final wish for his parents to reunite came true when Bill and Pat lived together in Los Angeles during Bill's final years. Susan Raymond later concluded, "Craig didn't destroy the family. Craig destroyed himself, and the families are fine." Mike Darnell, a former child actor who stood just 5'2", transformed television at Fox through pure hustle and a keen understanding of audience appetites. After acting in 1970s sitcoms and commercials as a kid who could play mouthy ethnics, Darnell abandoned performing at 20 to pursue his true passion, television itself. He obsessively studied ratings, collected TV guides, and memorized Nielsen statistics like sports fans tracked batting averages. Desperate to escape his library job at KTTV, which Fox had purchased, Darnell created a rogue project called Life After Reruns, interviewing Batman's Robin actor, Burt Ward. When Tim Burton's Batman film premiered in 1989, Darnell's piece caught Fox president Barry Diller's attention, earning him a promotion. Still hungry for advancement, Darnell ambushed Diller at a film premiere and later sent him a Mission Impossible-style self-destructing briefcase message, a stunt that incredibly worked. By 1994, Darnell became Fox's head of specials, overseeing paranormal shows like Encounters: The Hidden Truth. When producer Robert Kiviat brought him supposed footage of an alien autopsy from 1947, Darnell recognized his P.T. Barnum moment. Alien Autopsy, fact or fiction, became Fox's highest-rated special ever, despite or because of its questionable authenticity. The footage, actually created by British artist John Humphreys using sheep brains, jam, and chicken entrails, became a cultural touchstone referenced on Seinfeld and The Simpsons. Like P.T. Barnum before him, Darnell had created entertainment that thrived in the ambiguous space between truth and fiction, training audiences in cynical credulity that would define American culture across reality TV, news, and eventually politics. After Alien Autopsy succeeded, Darnell unleashed a flood of low-budget clip shows with sensationalist titles like When Animals Attack, The World's Deadliest Swarms, and When Stunts Go Bad. These compilations of pre-existing footage outraged critics while delighting viewers and executives. Darnell's genius was monetizing undervalued content like news footage and surveillance video, materials he'd once discarded as a station librarian. By the late 1990s, Darnell was producing 50 to 70 specials yearly and charming journalists who had once denounced him. He compared his TV style to pizza. "It doesn't matter what your SAT scores are or how much money you make, most people still like pizza." Critic Tom Vanderbilt celebrated Darnell's approach in the New York Times, noting how he transformed the highlight sports reel, the all-climax porn compilation, into modern pop art. At the millennium's turn, Darnell had become a powerful network mentor who could make careers. He connected with Mike Fleiss, another TV-loving striver who caught Darnell's attention with his nasty approach. Together, they developed increasingly outrageous concepts like World's Dumbest Drivers and the never-aired World's Biggest Bitches. Their philosophy, the more divisive a show was, the higher the ratings. Their collaboration culminated in Who Wants to Marry a Multimillionaire in 2000, a live special where 50 women competed to marry a millionaire they'd never met. The show drew 23 million viewers, but collapsed days later when The Smoking Gun revealed the millionaire, Rick Rockwell, had a restraining order filed by an ex-fiancée. Fox immediately canceled all follow-ups and instituted a no more reality shows policy. Despite predictions that reality TV was dead, major networks were secretly calling Darnell. The ratings were too big to ignore. Survivor was the first series to take reality television mainstream in America, transforming a fringe phenomenon into a legitimate institution. Its genius lay in uniting three traditions: Alan Funt's pranks, Chuck Barris-style game shows, and real-life soap opera pioneered by An American Family. Though it appeared distinctly American, Survivor wasn't American at all. The concept originated with Charlie Parsons, born in 1958 to a posh British family. After attending Oxford, Parsons found work at Network 7, a revolutionary broadcast tabloid. In 1988, they aired Castaway, featuring four strangers marooned in Sri Lanka. This experiment convinced Parsons there was brilliant television in watching strangers bond under pressure. For nearly a decade, Parsons pitched his desert island concept, originally titled Survive, getting rejected by every British and American network. In the mid-1990s, he found support from Michael Davies, a British expat producer at Disney. Together, they developed the concept, strangers stranded on a desert island, playing games, and getting eliminated one by one. In 1996, Davies assembled a dream team of producers who had their eureka moment. Contestants would compete for immunity, symbolic protection from death. This transformed the concept from a mere game show into the Game of Life, a three-act drama with tribal competitions, reward challenges, and the crucial Island Council where teammates would vote each other off. After years of American rejection, Parsons finally sold the concept to Sweden's SVT in 1996. Filmed in Malaysia and renamed Expedition Robinson, the show followed Parsons' blueprint perfectly. But tragedy struck when Sinisa Savia, the first contestant voted off, committed suicide by walking in front of a train 9 weeks before the premiere. Despite initial horror and ethical questions, the show became a hit by its second season. Mark Burnett, a former British paratrooper turned American entrepreneur, had been pursuing Parsons for years, attempting to buy this Survive format. After years of rejection, Parsons finally agreed to sell in 1998. Burnett's path to CBS came through Gen Maynard, a young Japanese-American executive who worked strategically behind the scenes for a year. When Burnett finally met with CBS president Les Moonves, he delivered a mesmerizing pitch with mocked-up Time and Newsweek covers predicting the show's success. What ultimately convinced the skeptical Moonves was Burnett's business proposition. The show would cost CBS nothing up front, with sponsors covering the entire budget. Though Burnett would only earn $35,000 per episode, he structured a deal giving him half of the advertising money, an arrangement CBS would later regret. In March 2000, 16 castaways began filming on Pulau Tiga, Malaysia. The production operated with military precision through three divisions: challenges for competitions, reality for personal interactions, and tribal council for the dramatic ejection ceremonies. Everyone struggled with the harsh conditions, which teemed with dangerous wildlife, including monitor lizards, monkeys, and venomous snakes. Over 39 days, a compelling narrative emerged organically from the game format. The younger Pagong tribe treated the experience like vacation, while in Tagi, four players formed a secret alliance. Richard Hatch, the gay corporate consultant, bonded with homophobic Navy SEAL Rudy, then joined forces with Sue and Kelly. After eliminating their own tribe members, the alliance systematically targeted Pagong members after the merge. The first season was consumed with the ethical question of whether it was right to compete strategically at all. Most castaways clung to the notion that the show should be a meritocracy, producing a worthy winner. From this perspective, forming alliances seemed corrupt. Kelly summed up the dilemma. How do you stay true to yourself and maintain integrity and still play the game? And you know what? You can't. The final tribal council featured Sue Hawk's legendary snake and rat speech against Kelly, a venomous tirade supporting Richard that became one of reality TV's most iconic moments. Richard Hatch, whom Burnett initially thought would be eliminated first, won the $1 million. Survivor's May 31, 2000 debut smashed every ratings record, even beating Friends. When 57.3 million viewers watched the finale, reality television had officially become America's new obsession. After the scandal of Who Wants to Marry a Multimillionaire, Mike Flies found himself broke and blacklisted in the industry. While nursing a fever in early 2001, he conceived the framework for The Bachelor, complete with roses, hometown visits, and fantasy suites, determined to create a hit that would redeem his reputation. The first season established manipulative production techniques that would define reality television for years. Producers badgered contestants like Rhonda until she broke down on camera, with Fleiss celebrating her hyperventilation as proof this thing's working. Though Rhonda claims there were no paramedics despite what aired, her meltdown became a blueprint for future seasons. The show created a formula: sweet girls, there for the right reasons, versus villains and unstable contestants. As casting associate Costello noted, unstable and pretty? That's gold. The production team perfected techniques to manufacture drama through editing and manipulation, repurposing any emotional reaction to serve the narrative. Inside the production, chaos reigned. The non-unionized crew worked around the clock in a bubble similar to the contestants. Producers received cash bonuses for making girls cry on camera, while Fleiss and executive producer Lisa Levinson conducted an open affair despite both being married. Fleiss, who later got sober in 2010, described this period as rockstar time, with heavy drinking and drug use throughout production. Though Alex chose Amanda, their relationship collapsed when she discovered he'd slept with Trista during filming. Trista became the first bachelorette and found lasting love with firefighter Ryan Sutter, eventually negotiating payment for their televised wedding. Despite the show's bone-deep sexism, its true power lay in its ability to capture genuine emotions within an artificial environment, the dark magic that fueled the genre. Fox's Joe Millionaire emerged as a warped satire of The Bachelor, premiering in November 2002 to Fleiss's fury. Created by Mike Darnell's team at Fox, the show's premise came from a simple suggestion: why don't we lie to them? 20 bachelorettes competed for Evan Marriott, a construction worker they believed had inherited $50 million, who'd been hastily trained to fake wealth. The show's most notorious moment, suggesting contestant Sarah Kozer performed oral sex on Evan in the woods, was fabricated out of whole cloth by repurposing audio from a massage scene. This ethical violation became the show's selling point, with Sarah portrayed as a scheming slut against Zora Andrich's saintly substitute teacher. With 40 million viewers for its finale, more than the Oscars, Joe Millionaire exposed dating shows as humiliating cons rather than romantic journeys. Evan briefly enjoyed fame before Fox took away his lot pass, eventually returning to construction work with a newfound appreciation for honest labor. Like Fleiss, he came to loathe reality television. Producers are the sheep herders, and we are the sheep. By the early 2000s, reality television had evolved from fringe entertainment to dominant cultural force. The genre created opportunities for creative misfits, failed scriptwriters, broke documentarians, ex-military personnel, while ordinary people flooded casting agencies, all hoping to become the next Richard Hatch. As technology accelerated with the internet's growth, reality TV's confessional nature merged perfectly with an increasingly exhibitionist culture. Celebreality launched in March 2002 with MTV's The Osbournes, transforming washed-up metalhead Ozzy Osbourne into a lovable sitcom dad. The show flipped reality TV's premise by turning stars into ordinary people rather than ordinary people into stars. Early celebreality shows mimicked family sitcoms. The Osbournes updated Married with Children, Newlyweds marketed itself as the new I Love Lucy, and John Murray's The Simple Life reimagined Greenacres with Paris Hilton and Nicole Richie. For Jessica Simpson, Newlyweds initially felt liberating compared to her music career, allowing her to be imperfect on camera. But when her marriage to Nick Lachey began crumbling, the show's invasiveness became unbearable. When producers refused to stop filming during private moments, saying, "If we keep having to stop rolling, there's no show," the couple's relationship deteriorated further. As reality shows proliferated, exploitation intensified across the industry. Producer Jude Wang described being physically attacked by an enraged producer, but with no unions or HR departments, there was nowhere to report such incidents. Dangerous stunts regularly went wrong. A contestant on Dog Eat Dog claimed brain damage from a breath-holding challenge. A The Chamber participant developed hypothermia, and a Survivor contestant required airlift evacuation after falling into fire. In 2004, The Apprentice debuted, featuring Donald Trump as a business genius evaluating potential employees. Behind the scenes, Trump regularly made crude comments about female contestants and allegedly asked during the final competition between Kwame Jackson and Bill Rancic, "Yeah, but would America really buy a nigger winning?" The comment stunned the room into nervous silence before someone quickly changed the subject. The crew regularly witnessed Trump's sexist behavior, including constant commentary on female contestants' bodies and complaints that women weren't hot enough. Despite long hours and low pay, many crew members defended their work against criticism from traditional TV writers, seeing reality TV as more innovative than sitcoms. Too bad it turned into a Black Mirror episode, one later reflected about Trump's political rise. By 2007, Bravo launched The Real Housewives of Orange County, featuring glamour shots of mansions and blonde women discussing breast implants, spoiled children, and eventually divorces and bankruptcies. Producer Doug Ruppel, who had written for General Hospital, knew soap operas needed tears, sex, and emotion. He struggled to get cast members to open up, once deputizing female producers to film Kimberly Bryant privately during a skin cancer scare. Both The Real Housewives and Keeping Up with Kardashians defined reality TV of this era, shows that proudly foregrounded their artificiality by casting women who already saw themselves as public figures. Femininity functioned as vaudeville performance, with emotions outlined in neon. Debuting shortly before the 2008 economic crash, these shows became convenient outlets for class rage against the symbolic trophy wives of the 1%. Reality TV evolved from being repeatedly dismissed as a fad since the 1940s to becoming an entrenched part of entertainment culture. The genre's beginning ended around 2004 with The Apprentice's product integration innovations, or perhaps 2006 when cast members began seeing themselves as influencers and brand representatives rather than mere subjects. For over half a century, naivete was reality television's crucial ingredient. Participants trusted producers as friends and mentors, skimming contracts and asking few questions. This created a paradox where less ethical production methods often yielded more authentic footage. After Survivor, this naivete began dissolving as contestants became savvy collaborators who understood that crying or fighting meant screen time. Modern reality participants often approach shows as extreme emotional sports rather than making naive missteps, consciously choosing to experience love or physical challenges before a global audience. Despite growing contestant awareness, casting departments still select vulnerable people who don't fully understand the implications of contracts that forbid complaints about editing manipulation. The most profound shift in reality television wasn't among producers or participants, but viewers. For decades, audiences were merely casual rubberneckers fascinated by the latest spectacle. By the early 2000s, however, a new generation had embraced reality TV as a legitimate genre with dedicated fandoms following specific formats or subgenres. These viewers, whether Bravoholics or Bachelor Nation members, engaged in surprisingly profound discussions about seemingly shallow content, creating a shared language of memes, in-jokes, and cultural references. Trump's presidency was filled with reality TV-style stunts, from his escalator descent announcement to staged cabinet meetings resembling apprentice boardrooms. Industry figures like Mike Fleiss saw Trump's rise as an indelible stain on the genre, while others like Fenton Bailey argued that Trump corrupts everything he touches rather than reality TV corrupting politics. Producer Bill Pruitt acknowledged The Apprentice's role in elevating Trump, but pointed out that many institutions, from the New York Times to Fox News to publishers, shared responsibility for ignoring the danger Trump posed because he was too good for business. Despite persistent cultural divides between scripted and unscripted production, highlighted during the 2023 WGA and SAG-AFTRA strikes, reality TV developed into its own distinct profession with established craft, traditions, and university courses. Reality veterans developed defiant pride in their skills, with many noting they could accomplish more with less preparation than scripted productions. For all its ethical problems and exploitation, reality television fundamentally changed how we understand entertainment, celebrity, and even ourselves. It created a world where ordinary people could become famous simply for being themselves, or versions of themselves, where authenticity became both prized and performative, and where the line between public and private life permanently blurred. In doing so, it didn't just reflect our culture, it transformed it, for better and for worse.